This is episode 59 of the Fifth Estate podcast. John Favreau, when the left collides with the right.
Hey there, Fifth Estate fans. Neil Doing here to tell you about our friends at Blue Apron. And joining me is my lovely wife, Rachel. Say hi, Rachel.
Hello.
Rachel, did you know that Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country?
I did.
I bet you also knew that their mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone.
I knew that already.
I know. And Blue Apron achieves this. Stop me if you've heard this one. By supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. Isn't that amazing?
Wow.
What's your favorite thing about Blue Apron?
I really love that it's so easy.
You know, it is easy. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients. It can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. Even I can do it. So, what was one of your favorite meals that we had?
I really liked the coconut curry shrimp.
Oh, that was good. That was good. Did you enjoy the process of preparing it?
I did. It was really easy. And I'm a pretty good cook, or at least I think I am. And I really liked the fact that all I had to do was take everything out of the box, open it all up, and put it together.
For the record, you are a great cook, but when we have Blue Apron, it kicks it up a notch. And you don't have to go traveling all over creation to get these ingredients. They come right to the door, right to your door. Some of the upcoming meals, seared chicken and creamy pasta salad with summer squash and sweet peppers. They've got creamy shrimp rolls with quick pickles and sweet potato wedges. Then there's fresh basil fettuccine pasta with sweet corn and cubanelle peppers. Finally, chile butter steaks with Parmesan potatoes and spinach. That sounds good. So, folks, if this sounds like something you'd be interested in, check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/fifth. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait.
That's blueapron.com/fifth.
It is time for another episode of The Fifth Estate. My name is Jay Caruso. I'm here with my co-host, Mr. Neil Doing. How are you?
Jay, I'm doing fine. How are you?
Doing pretty well. Doing pretty well. It's raining here in Dallas, my new home.
Well, you know, weather does happen, I'm told.
Yeah, you know, it went from like being 99 degrees and disgustingly hot to, you know, now it's raining and still kind of nasty out, but it's all right. Dallas is a good city. Good city. So, as you know, as always, everyone, you know, we're starting off the show. We implore you to go out to iTunes. We like hearing what you have to say about us. We like getting reviews. We like getting star ratings. It's always
good. I'm not going to beg, but, you know, it would be nice if they would toss us a 5-star if they're so inclined. You know, I could take it or leave it, honestly.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's nice. Take it or leave it.
I mean, we got a pretty good show, right?
We Chase? Do.
Pretty good show.
We do. We're doing
5 stars.
We're doing something new here today, this week.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, one of the reasons we started the show was to actually learn stuff, to kind of break out of those comfortable little boxes that we set up for ourselves. And to that end, we're going to bring some politics into the show, and we're going to bring some politics from the other side in to talk to us.
Yeah, and this happened. This is all because of a civil disagreement on Twitter. If you can imagine, it happened. It actually was civil. I think it had to do with, you know, it's funny, about the killing of Osama bin Laden, and I said that Obama didn't really credit George W., didn't give George W. Bush any credit, and our guest said, hey, hold on a second, that's not true, and then we kind of went back and forth, and we were trying to talk about how we were both trying to be less of a dick or something like that online. So that, and so when this idea, you brought up this idea, I said, well, why don't we try and get this guy?
Yeah.
And so.
Yeah, yeah. He's got a good thing going. Let's just go ahead and bring him in. Let's get the party started, Jay.
Yeah. So former speechwriter for President Obama and currently one of three hosts of Pod Save America, probably the most popular political podcast in the United States. John Favreau's here. John, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys. We're only popular because we begged people for 5-star ratings. So I think you're on the right track here, guys.
It does work.
It works. All you have to do is ask. It's not that hard.
Oh man, this is great. This is great. Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, thanks so much for being with us, John. And you know, we're gonna get into the politics here in a minute. But first, you know, for those who may not know who you are, if you could, you know, maybe just give us a brief little background on yourself.
Sure. I started working for Barack Obama when he was in the Senate. I sat down with him on his first week in the Senate in 2005. I had just come off the losing John Kerry campaign. I was very young. I was like 22, 23 at the time. Started working for him as his speechwriter in the Senate office, thinking that at least I wouldn't have to go through another presidential campaign anytime soon. And then, sure enough, 2007, he decided to run for president. I moved to Chicago, joined the campaign, went away with the circus, and then that was my life. I was his speechwriter up until March of 2013, when I left the White House after 8 years of writing for him, and I was very exhausted. And yeah, and then a couple, probably last year, we started a little political podcast called Keeping It 1600, and now it's called Pod Save America. We decided to keep it going post-Trump because it seems like there's lots to talk about, and that's where I am now.
Yeah, it seems to change hour by hour. There's always something new to mull over. Yeah,
there's never a lack of material, that's for sure.
There is not. I wanted to ask you a quick question about speech writing, you know.
Sure.
With a politician like Barack Obama, you know, he's got a great voice. He's got a good delivery. You know, in your opinion, you know, obviously as a speechwriter, I'm sure you're a little bit biased, but how much of a really good speech is what the speechwriter puts on the page and what the politician does with it? Like, how much like raw material do you have to work with there?
Yeah, I was very lucky with Obama. I mean, the only experience I had before Obama was Kerry, and I've had some experiences since Obama, but I think Obama was unique in that since he has always been a writer himself, he gave me a lot to go on. And so, you know, when I started with him, I had Dreams for My Father to read, and then I was in the Senate office for a couple years. And so before every speech, we sat down, we talked for 20, 30 minutes about what was on his mind before a speech. I would just take notes based on everything he said. And so by the time I churned out a first draft, I had a pretty good idea of how he thought and what was on his mind. I think that's unusual with most politicians. Like, I never, you know, I worked on the Kerry campaign for a while, but I never really got to know John Kerry. And so I think when it comes to the relationship between a speechwriter and the person that they're writing for, I think you need to know the person. You need to get to know the person as much as possible. And I think the speechwriters that don't succeed are the ones who never really get to know the person that they're writing for or have to go through a communications director or a senior advisor or anything like that. And so, you know, your job is to not only figure out how the person speaks, but how they think. And that takes a lot of time. And I was able to maintain and form that relationship with him, so which is why it worked out okay.
Yeah, I always think that kind of stuff is really fascinating, you know. And I guess kind of moving into the present day, if you you know, had to handicap maybe President Trump's speechifying, I don't know, what's your diagnosis there?
Well, it's hard because
how much liquor does that speechwriter have to go through?
But I don't, honestly, I've been trying to figure this out. I don't even know if there's a speechwriting team in the White House right now. Like, I know that Stephen Miller works on speeches. I know that Bannon has his hand in there sometimes. Maybe Kushner does. but I don't think he has a traditional speechwriting team. And it's weird with Trump because he just sort of says whatever's on his mind and tweets whatever's on his mind. You can tell with him when he's reading a speech off a prompter that it is like, you know, a Miller Bannon put together, carefully constructed speech versus when Trump just goes off the cuff. So it's even more noticeable with him. And so, you know, because I don't ever imagine Trump sitting down with his speech writing team making edits, right? Or like writing himself. It's all just sort of whatever, you know, just it's just a lot of diarrhea of the mouth with him. And so when he's actually on a prompter, it looks weird. And it sounds sort of weird. It sounds like he's a little stilted because he's not usually like that.
Yeah, and then it's interesting because even when he is on script, you can tell when he goes off script. The speech to the police, in front of the police, was a perfect example because the whole push their head down and all that other kind of stuff. If you listen to it 30 seconds before that, he was looking at the teleprompter. He was given the speech that was written for him. But he's almost like he's one of these guys that stands up at a dinner party and they're supposed to give a toast and then they decide to tell a really lousy joke in the middle of it. And they think it's funny and it's not, you know, and I think that's what he tries to do. It's like almost like he wants to be a party guy. Like when I say party guy, I don't mean political party. I mean the party guy. So he's like, let me make a joke here. I think it'll be funny. And
he's more like what Bill Clinton was like as a speech giver than Obama or even Bush, right? Like when you talk to Clinton speechwriters, they'd say that they'd write these speeches for him, they'd put them in the prompter, they'd have the final speech, and then Bill Clinton would read a paragraph and then just sort of go off on his own, just tell some story, anecdote. And it usually worked well for Clinton, or sometimes it worked well for Clinton, right?
Yes.
With Obama, he would make a lot of edits and rewrites, but he would make sure that right before he stepped up on stage, what was in the prompter was almost the final version. And it had a lot of him in it. It had more of him in it than most speeches do. But he wouldn't go off script that much. And I think that was true. When I talked to Bush speechwriters, they'd say that's true of Bush as well. But Trump is just all improvisation because you can tell he's trying to break free of the speech that's on the page, which, you know, I think probably worked for him in certain ways in the campaign, but maybe less so in the White House.
Right. Well, kind of breaking away from Trump for a minute and kind of talking about the left-right divide in the country.
Yeah.
Do you think now that it's more pronounced than it was, say, in the Obama era? Or is it really just the same with a different cast of characters?
I think it's a bit more pronounced. I think that the divide that's more pronounced to me is Democrat, Republican, not necessarily left and right. I feel as though ideology has become a bit scrambled, specifically because of Trump, right? I think you have, you guys would know this better than me, but I think you have some Republicans who are free market conservatives, you know, who are maybe more culturally liberal in certain parts of the country. I think you've got Trump types who are maybe more culturally conservative but more economically populist these days. And I think in the Democratic Party you have that too. You sort of have people in the coasts and in the cities who are more culturally liberal. Maybe they care less about economic issues. And then you have a lot of these Obama-Trump voters in the heartland who are more economically populist again but a little more culturally conservative. And so on the ideology side, I think you've got a bit of a scramble. But in terms of partisanship, in terms of people who identify as Republicans, people who identify as Democrats, that seems to be the sort of the identity that is more important than almost anything else: class, gender, race. It's very pronounced, and I think that Trump has contributed to that, but I also think the media has contributed to that as well, and not just the partisan media, though I think the partisan media in a big way, but I think just television news in general and Twitter and everything's very reductive, everything's very sensational, and it's noisier than it ever has been. And everyone feels like they can just yell about anything and say whatever they want, and that's partially a response to Trump being president as well, and I think that has hardened the partisan divisions a bit more than we've seen.
No, I think you're right about that. I think there's an entertainment aspect to even serious mainstream news outlets now, and yeah. You know, it's something that's been brewing for a long time. I think the documentary about William F. Buckley and Gore Vidal having that debate made a pretty persuasive case that was the beginning of the era of cable shouting programs. You know, that was like the genesis of that sort of format.
It's one of the reasons why I really enjoy doing podcasts now, because I think you can have a better conversation, a more nuanced, subtle conversation when you have the time to do it than when you're on cable for 5 minutes. Like, I don't go on cable. I don't do cable news stuff anymore. I do it very rarely, because when you're on there, especially when you're on there with someone from the other side, you have like 3 minutes to get your talking points out, make your point. You have to speak up and argue if you want to be heard. It's like a fucking disaster.
It is. And these are complex issues. I mean, these are things you can't explain in 3 minutes. You can't explain healthcare reform in 3 minutes.
No.
Regardless of what President Trump may have thought when he put minimal effort into passing his own bill, you can't just coast along. But I wanted to turn to the politics. And obviously, we're going to disagree on a lot of the issues. And I'm interested in kind of finding common ground and getting your take on things from a perspective that a lot of our listeners probably don't hear too often. And one of the things that I've been interested in is this idea that Trump, the guy, raises the political cost of doing like the most anodyne Republican thing. If it was a different Republican in office, yes, no illusions here. The Democrats would not be rolling over and being, oh, this is great. Yeah, sure. There would still be, I'm sure, political maneuvering and opposition, and it would be unfair and people would scream and holler. But I feel like something about Trump just raises that political cost. Deregulation, for instance. I don't know. What's your cut on the deregulation?
I think this is true in a way that, but I think it's true because for a few reasons. One, I think there's a lot of people who are paying closer attention to what Trump does. And particularly there are people who've never paid attention to politics before Trump. So maybe they've been disengaged. Maybe they had things thought politics was boring or it was just noisy. And then because Trump won and people didn't think Trump would win, suddenly there's this very scary moment for a lot of people that Donald Trump is president for a number of reasons. And therefore, because you're scared of Trump, or because you fear Trump, or because you think he's bad, or you're angry about Trump, everything he does, you start attaching some super nefarious motive to, right? Or you think it's out of the mainstream. You think it's not normal. And it's interesting for me because I've paid attention to politics for so long, like I can separate out what I don't like about Trump because it's what Republicans usually do, and I'm a Democrat, and I just have a different ideology, versus what Trump's doing that I think is outside the bounds of what any president, Democrat or Republican, would do. So the constant lying, and of course people think in this country, oh, politicians always lie, but I would say that Trump lies far, far more than any Democratic or Republican president we've ever had, or most Democratic and Republican politicians that we've ever had, right? So it's the lying, it's the threatening of the press, it's his degradation of institutions, it's how he's been with Russia, it's the tweets, it's the yelling, it's the meanness, the nastiness. Like, I just think it's so, I think the way he started the administration, right, the way that the travel ban was handled, the way it was rolled out, right, like even I could see myself being against any kind of ban that seemed to affect a certain religion, but the way that it was rolled out, the way it was handled, just made it that much worse, and I think setting the tone as he did from the beginning of the administration was so much chaos and so much just, I don't know, it just seemed like such a circus and a scary circus at times, that I think for that reason, so many people start looking at anything he does as, outside the bounds of normal politics, when, like you said, I think like the deregulation agenda we would have gotten from almost any Republican who won.
So, all right. So then let me ask you this, because your answer raises an important point, because I have been seeing, you know, that Jeff Flake wrote this article where he's talking about the Republican Party, he's talking about Trump. And some of the responses I've seen to it are come, in my view, are a little ridiculous. You know, this whole idea, like 538 did that thing where they said that, you know, Ben Sasse speaks about, you know, talks about Trump, but votes with him 95% of the time. But, you know, in a situation like that, it's, you know, one of those votes may be to have confirmed Neil Gorsuch. To me, it's kind of silly to expect Ben Sasse or Mike Lee or anybody else or Jeff Flake to vote against confirming Neil Gorsuch simply because it's Donald Trump who nominated him, because that voting to confirm Gorsuch is pretty much what you talked about. That's kind of normal, everyday Republican orthodoxy. They're going to confirm somebody like that. So it's kind of switching to the Jeff Flake article, what do you consider? Where is, you know, in thinking about it and saying that you could separate the politics from the other stuff that he does, what would you think that Republicans need to do in order to kind of show that, you know, they really are like tired of this kind of nonsense that's coming from the White House?
Yeah. I mean, look, I want a Democratic senator to replace Jeff Flake. I want that because I didn't, you know, agree with Jeff Flake's the way he approached healthcare, right? I didn't think he should support Trump care, right? Like, those positions, though, have nothing to do with his relationship with Donald Trump. So, like, correct. I can want a Democratic senator to replace Jeff Flake and still respect Jeff Flake for speaking up against Donald Trump like he did. And I do. You know, that was my take. It wasn't like, you know, now we should expect Jeff Flake to be some liberal. He shouldn't be a liberal. He's a conservative, so he should go be a conservative. That doesn't stop me from wanting to run someone against him, you know?
Right.
But it does make me think, like, wow, good for him that he was able to speak up against Trump when so many other Republican politicians haven't. Like, for example, I think there are a lot of very sharp, good, fair conservative critiques of Donald Trump that I see from conservatives who are on Twitter or writers or journalists, and you never hear them from Republican politicians. You don't hear them from Paul Ryan or Mitch McConnell, right? So, like, I think that, like, you know, we can expect conservatives to draw a line at Trump firing or even threatening to fire Mueller, right? To call him out when he attacks the press or peddles conspiracy theories about, you know, wiretapping Barack Obama, wiretapping him, or, you know, 3 million illegal voters and all that kind of shit, right? Like, there are times when I think Republican politicians could stand up and say, this is garbage coming from the president. And you know what? He is, because he's focusing on this, he's not focusing on keeping his campaign promises, which is to create jobs and to help the middle class and to bring the economy back. You know, like, there's a way for Republicans to not be scared of Trump when he's doing this kind of stuff, but say, like, look, all your focus on all this crazy shit is preventing you from doing what we told the voters we were going to do. And, like, those Republican politicians, they can be champions of people as opposed to the guy sitting in the White House. Now, I know that's tough, because I know it's tough politics and you're worried about the base and you're worried about primary challenges and all the rest. But that's the kind of stuff that I think is, you know, that Republicans should be standing up on.
Yeah, it is difficult. You know, I think conservatives, one of the big kind of psychic traumas of 2016 was that conservatives realized that they're actually a minority in the Republican Party. They're not in charge. They're not in the driver's seat. And so I think we're still sort of finding our way through that realization. I wanted to go to the flip side of the coin here and talk about sort of, you know, the way that Democrats have approached their critiques of Trump. Now, obviously, they're more free to disagree with Trump without political cost, but have Democrats on the whole been smart in their critiques of Trump? You know, you mentioned earlier assigning a nefarious purpose to everything. It's like always at 11. That sort of, you know, it sort of dilutes the I would say reasonable alarm that people should feel. So how do you feel about generally how the Democrats have approached or navigated the era of Trump?
Yeah, look, I mean he's given us quite a bit to sort through on a daily basis, and oftentimes, you know, he's done 10 things that would have sunk any other president, or that, you know, everyone would have been up in arms about for a full month if it had been any other Democratic or Republican president. And he does it all within a day, right? So there's a lot of opportunities to take things to 11. I have been trying not to take everything to 11 because, one, I think, like you said, you need to be able to, when he really does something that's outside the bounds of you know, normal politics or something that damages our institutions or our values, I think you have to be, you know, you have to be ready to call those things out and not just say that everything is awful all the time. But more importantly, I think, like, I don't think our message can be Trump is awful and that's it. And, like, I'm reminded of when Obama was running in 07 and he was in a primary, you know, with Hillary Clinton and John Edwards and a bunch of other Democrats. And, you know, they all spent a lot of time bashing Bush, as we did as a party for a long, long time. A lot of it for good reason, I think, but that's what we did. But at one point, in order to sort of separate Obama out from the rest of the field, I remember we wrote this, this Jefferson Jackson dinner speech in Iowa, and the way that the speech started was, you know, the one thing that we can all agree on, the one thing we all know, is that George Bush isn't going to be president next year. So the question we have to ask ourselves is, what's next? What's after Bush? Forget about Bush. We don't have to talk about Bush the whole time. What's next for the country? And it was interesting because Hillary's speech and Edwards' speech were so heavy with Bush this, Bush that, you know, Bush sucks. And the audience and even these, like, very liberal partisans really appreciated Obama focusing on what was beyond Bush. And I think Democrats at some point, especially when the election starts, when we get into campaign season again, are going to have to look beyond Trump, because, like, people's dislike of Trump is baked in. You know, like, you don't have to hit that too much, right? Like, his approval rating is in the tank. People don't like him, and I think people want to hear what you're going to do differently. And so I do think that, and it's hard. Like, I don't abide by this all the time. I'm on Twitter all the time attacking Trump just because, like I said, he gives us so much to go on every day. But I think at some point there's going to need to be some focus and discipline on, you know, a positive agenda.
So, okay, so in looking at that and talking about the divide, but where do you think there are some areas where Democrats and Republicans can still work together? Is there anything out there that you think that maybe there might be something, like, for example, I could throw out, you know, prison sentencing reform, you know, something.
That was going to be my suggestion.
Okay.
I mean, you got Rand Paul and I saw Rand Paul and Kamala Harris together, you know, on a doing an interview the other day talking about the subject. And I was like, that's a pretty odd pairing. You know, if you can get those two together, that seems like an issue you can make progress on.
Right. Anything else that comes to mind?
Look, I think there was a time when infrastructure was bipartisan, right? I mean, I don't, and I know that, you know, when you're talking about how to fund infrastructure, obviously Democrats are going to want more government funding. Obviously Republicans are going to say, you know, we want more of the private sector involved and try to leverage more funding that way. And so you can sort of work that out. But just imagine if Trump had started with an infrastructure plan. I know as a Democrat, I would have felt like we were in a bit of a bind because, you know, some of the party was like, don't work with Trump no matter what. But if he had come up with this, I mean, if he had come up with the infrastructure plan that Bannon was floating around, which is like $1 trillion in spending, which I'm sure would have sent most of the conservatives, you know, for their fainting couches, especially like Paul Ryan, if it's like $1 trillion in government spending. But if Trump had gone with a plan like that, then I think it would have put Democrats in a tough place because we would have to say, okay, well, this is going to create jobs. This is what we believe in. We've proposed this ourselves. Why would we say no to it? Instead, you know, he didn't do that. And I don't know if he's ever going to get around to infrastructure spending, but I think you could get an infrastructure bill that has bipartisan support. I think you could do criminal justice reform. I think, you know, aside from Trump, there's a lot of agreement between Democrats and Republicans on how to deal with Russia at this point. And I know a lot of Republicans will say, oh, where were you in the Obama era on Russia, Democrats? Well, now we're here. and I think the sanctions bill that just passed is evidence of that. So I even think on some of the foreign policy stuff, there could be some bipartisan work there. But I think Trump has made a lot of these things difficult. Like I would have said before Trump was president, immigration reform is a place where Democrats and Republicans can work together, because I think there are still enough Republicans who wanted to, you know, pass immigration reform. But now, like, you know, looking at Paul Ryan's Twitter feed yesterday when he has like a video up about, you know, how we need to build the wall, that just seems to me like Paul Ryan has traveled such a distance on immigration reform than where he used to be.
It's true. It's true. You know, this is so great. And, you know, we're running short of time and that's killing me, honestly. But I wanted to hit one more thing.
Sure. I can say a few more minutes.
Oh, awesome. This is a point where I don't think Democrats and Republicans can really agree, and where they haven't really shown any aptitude for working together. And that is on the ACA, AKA mm-hmm. Obamacare.
Yes.
You know, from the conservative perspective, of course, it is a horrible, no good, very bad law. And we would like to see the back end of it, you know, from a Democratic perspective. I see some people who seem to think that there's absolutely nothing wrong with it and that it should be left pristine and untouched. And then I hear more nuanced arguments to say, okay, yeah, we need to address the structural flaws, but it shouldn't be repealed. In your opinion, where can Democrats go on the ACA? Where can they give on it? And sort of where do you see the ACA going from here?
Yeah. I think it definitely is improving. I think that obviously prices are still too high, premiums are still too high, deductibles are too high. Obviously you have insurers pulling out of markets. But, you know, I think the way, I mean, look, Obamacare was, on one hand, it was an insurance program. It was to get as many people covered as possible, right? On the other hand, there were all these measures in the bill to control costs, right? And there were a lot of reforms, and some of them were aimed at Medicare. And, you know, I used to be bored to death by Obama talking about bending the cost curve. But there has to be, we have to figure out a way to bring down the cost of healthcare. And I don't know, and I don't believe that the free market, just leaving it to the market alone, will bring down the cost of healthcare. And I think the most promising way to bring down the cost of healthcare is a lot of these cost reforms where, as opposed to, you know, paying for quantity, we're paying for quality, and we're looking at medical outcomes. And instead of doctors just, you know, prescribing a bunch more tests to people because that's how they make money, you know, they're rewarded based on healthier outcomes. And I think if you make that shift, and we're seeing this already in the healthcare system, if you slowly make that shift, you're going to start bringing overall healthcare costs down, and that will eventually help premiums and deductibles come down. I think in the short term, I mean, John Kasich today was just saying, look, Ohio had, you know, 20 different counties where there were no insurers in the markets, in the individual markets, and now, because he got to work and worked with insurers and everything, now 19 of 20 of those markets or those counties are covered, right? And so they actually made progress in bringing insurers back to the markets in Ohio. I believe, and we believed when we tried to pass the Affordable Care Act, that some kind of a public option in some of these markets would help insurance companies, would force insurance companies to be more competitive and bring down prices. And the CBO has scored this as saving money as well. So I'm a believer in, you know, not immediately going to Medicare for all and single payer, but to have a public option so that at least insurance companies can compete with the public option and compete for customers, and that will help bring down prices. So that's where I would ultimately go. That's my belief. I think what Democrats could give is, look, and I know this is part of this bipartisan reform that some people in Congress are talking about right now, but I think you could loosen the employer mandate. I don't think you can get rid of the individual mandate, because I think that causes the whole thing to collapse. And you could loosen the employer mandate so long as you give employees the option of buying coverage with the same level of subsidies that people in the individual market have. It is like a relic of the past that health insurance is still tied to your employer, right? We live in a world where people are going to switch employers a whole bunch of times. And so you know, if you loosen up that employer mandate a little bit, but still make sure that individuals have an opportunity to buy coverage that's affordable, I think that's one place where you could sort of loosen up on the regulations a bit.
That's really interesting. You know, these sort of just exchanges of ideas, they do not happen generally between the left and the right, especially on Twitter and other
hard forums. To get them in 140 characters.
It's certainly like, yeah. You just used like 1,003 characters, John. How is anybody supposed
way,
to?
Way I don't too know, much.
Yeah, it's way too much. It's way too much. But you know, we live in a republic, and we are stuck with one another, and that I think is the perspective people need to take, and that means that we need to, I think, recover this notion of accommodating one another. You know,
nobody has to give up on their core beliefs in order to do that. I mean, that's the whole thing. It's like, having a discussion or you know, sitting down and trying to hammer out something doesn't mean that you're abandoning your principles. This whole idea of like, oh, you know, I mean, you'll get shit about this show, and so will we. It's like, oh, all the people you have on, you have some Obama flack on there. I'm not listening, you know. And it's like, why not? Yeah. You know. So
it's just look, and I get it, and people, I had to just blame the media, because it's not like, I don't think it's a journalist problem or a reporter's problem, but it's sort of like the format of the media today, you know, is that everything is fast and loud, and people are scrolling through things so fast, and all they see is Chiron sometimes, and this, of course, is what caused the president to say half the things he does. But whenever I stop and think to myself, okay, why did this person say this on Twitter? Let's like research the issue a little bit. Let's look at it from both sides. Someone's written on it on the right. Someone's written on it on the left. Let's try to come to a conclusion about this. Like, I usually am still generally keep my belief in it, but I'm like, okay, well, I see at least where the other side's coming from. Like, right. I do think that developing a sense of empathy, that trying to put yourself in someone else's shoes and saying, okay, where are they coming from? What are they looking to do? What do they believe? And that helps a little bit, yeah, in my experience.
All right.
Excellent. Well, we've been talking to John Favreau, who is the co-host of Pod Save America, which, by the way, is an excellent show, and I enjoy it very much.
Thank you.
We do have, John, one more piece of business before we let you go. This is a gotcha question, and we spring this gotcha question on all our guests. We don't tell you in advance what it's going to be, and so we want the unvarnished truth. I think we've had a fair and frank exchange here, John, and I want to keep that going. And so my question to you, sir, which is better, the Beatles or the Rolling Stones?
I'm a Beatles guy.
Yes.
I just think it's more breadth. You know, you can go over the decades and you can find every, and it's just, the songwriting is just incredible. Incredible over there. So I'm a Beatles guy.
Well, you couldn't have known this beforehand, but Jay and I bitterly disagree on this subject, and I'm a little heartbroken now, but I'll get over it. I'll live.
Listen, and it's a perfect song, Neil. See, we can work it out.
Oh, perfect. There you go.
It's not that I hate the Beatles. They have some good stuff, but I just like the Rolling Stones a little bit more. But, well, okay, John, thank you so much. This was really a lot of fun, and I think we both learned a lot and really enjoyed talking to you.
I appreciate it, and thanks for having me on, guys. It was great. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks, John.
All right, take care.
All right, you too. John Favreau, everyone. Bye. Pod Save America. So, check that out. Listen to their podcast. I think even if you don't agree with those guys, I think if you're into politics, you'll enjoy it, even though you might get upset at some point. So if you're a conservative, you'll get upset. So Neil, great show.
Yes, sir. That was a great show, Jay. I sincerely enjoyed that.
Yeah.
And I agree that Pod Save America, you know, they're going to say things that if you're a conservative, if you're a Trump supporter, you're going to straight up dislike what they're saying. But it's very useful to listen to people you disagree with articulate their ideas.
Yep.
If for no other reason than to better understand their arguments and better refute them.
Exactly. Yeah. At least if you know where they're coming from, you know what they have to say, that when you do have a discussion with them, you're better prepared to counter rather than just saying you're just some leftist idiot. You don't know what you're talking about. So,
but on the more positive case is maybe you get to understand people and you realize that they're not evil. Liberals, leftists, what have you, they're not evil people. And I would say the same thing to anybody from the left who's listening to this show. Conservatives, we're not evil. We just disagree. And where we can disagree in good faith, let's disagree in good faith, and let's try to work together as best we can.
Yep.
I think if more people could take that perspective, we might be a little bit better off. But you know, I'm a pessimist, so I don't expect it to happen.
That's true. All right, well, that's going to do
again,
it.
Then again, maybe this show is proof that I'm wrong.
It's possible. It's possible. So, all right, well, that is going to do it for this episode of The Fifth Estate. As we said before, please go out there, subscribe to our podcast, tell your friends to subscribe, leave those ratings. We appreciate it. I'm Jake Russo. For Neil Dewing, we will see you next time on The Fifth Estate.